Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
George Hardcastle's downfall undoubtedly originated in his love for dogs. He could not pass one without stopping and patting its head. A flea-bitten Mongol had only to turn the corner of the street, and he was whistling, calling out, "Come on, boy, come on then," and behaving in an altogether outrageous fashion that is peculiar to the devoted animal lover. Tragedy may still have been averted had he not decided to spend the day in the Green Sand Hills, here in the region of Clandon Down, where dwarf oaks, pale birches, and dark firs spread up in a long sweep to the northern heights, was a vast hiding place where many forms of often invisible life lurked in the dense undergrowth. But George, like many before him, knew nothing about this, and tramped happily up the slope, aware only that the air was fresh, the silence absolute, and he was young.
Oh, man, to be young, dumb, and full of misconceptions. Sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yes, I believe that is the saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Some of our listeners, I've heard, have taken to calling themselves strangers. They're reclaiming the word.
Oh, you've heard this.
Strangers get unfairly maligned in the media. They're taking it back. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, I'm getting a correction from our producer. Uh-huh. I read that wrong. It's actually stranglers.
Oh, right.
And it's not they. It's just one of our listeners is a strangler. Man, I got that wrong. Well, regardless of what they call themselves, we call our listeners friends. Folks, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Today we are covering The Werewolf and the Vampire by R. Chetwynd Hayes.
I know we've referenced this author and this story many times over the years, most recently when we covered A Night in the Lonesome October, which felt a little like this one. I'm excited to talk about it, but first, I have to know, who was that reader?
That reader is Mike Mason.
Do you mean Mike Mason, the creative director for the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game?
The very same. And when not making Rad Call of Cthulhu books and accessories, Mike can be found cultivating his vintage French thimble collection. Mike has over 2,000 thimbles from all over France, from the beaches of Normandy to the shores of Nice. If you see Mike, make sure you ask him about thimbles. But be warned, he'll talk your ear off.
Well, I don't know about all that thimble stuff, but one thing I do know is that the updated edition of Nameless Horrors from Chaosium was released earlier this month. This is the second edition. It's in hardback. It's got a color interior, new layout, new art, new maps, and there'll be a special leatherette version of it as well, if you're into warm leatherettes.
Thank you, Mike, for reading.
This author, not a Lovecraftian author at all.
No.
Speaking of Call of Cthulhu, he does not run away from ghost story and traditional monster movie conventions, but he runs in, grabbing them all, stuffing them in his pockets like train tickets. Who is R. Chetwynd Hayes?
Ronald Henry Glynn Chetwynd Hayes was born in Middlesex in 1919, and he got a start as a seller and buyer of furniture.
Extra, extra, is it credenza? I imagine.
The first thing that he ever got published was a sci-fi novel in 1959 called The Man from the Bomb. He wrote 10 more novels and collections. Fun fact, he took over editing the Fontana Book of Great Ghost Stories from Robert Aikman.
Yeah, in 1973. I read the story in the Penguin Book of Vampire Stories, edited by Alan Ryan, and this story appears directly after Aikman's Pages from a Young Girl's Journal.
Ah.
So by featuring this author after Aikman on this show, we're only doing what's natural.
Yeah.
What's been done before.
Chetwynd Hayes broke into Hollywood with one of his stories was adapted for Rod Serling's Night Gallery. It was Something in the Woodwork from the year 1973.
That just, when I hear Something in the Woodwork in 1973, it just makes me think of that decor, the fake wood grain walls.
Yep.
It's like probably about a haunted macrame owl. Oh, it strangles me with its yarn tendrils, hooting wildly.
He also wrote a script for the TV series Spine Chillers in 1980. In 1981, his best-known movie came out, The Monster Club, with Vincent Price and John Carradine. John Carradine plays R. Chetwynd Hayes, who is attacked in the street by a very creepy Vincent Price.
Yeah, who's a vampire, like the most nonchalant vampire. You saw this movie when you were a kid.
Yes.
I didn't watch it back then.
No, no. The thing that I remember most about it was there is between the stories, there's like three stories that are told in this monster club, which is an 80s new wave club.
Yeah.
And everybody's just wearing rubber monster masks.
I know, they're all dancing around. It's weird because it seems like something I would really like. Well, that image is something I really like, actually. Sure. When all the monsters are just bobbing around and dancing, they're all wearing rubber masks. So they're just like expressionlessly dancing. To this new wave music, which, folks, it is not good.
No.
This movie came out in 1981, but we were talking about it before the show, and you were saying it just looks like it's something from way before.
It feels like it's got a 1960s vibe to it, maybe even early 70s. But when you see the new wave band, you're like, oh, yeah, this is definitely an 80s movie.
Yeah.
But there's a bit in there between the stories where there's a striptease and the woman is taking off her clothes and then it goes to a screen silhouette. She starts removing her skin. So she's a skeleton that's like taking off her skin as a striptease. And I remember being like, you know, 13 or 14,
yeah,
being kind of confused by the whole thing.
You're like, this is how this works?
Well, you know, it was like kind of sexy and then it kind of wasn't, but then it still kind of was. And I don't know how I should feel about this. It was very strange.
Well, there's some weird overtones in all of it because so I just turned on the movie yesterday because I thought I wondered if this story was adapted in it because the Monster Club is the collection of stories that this is from.
Yeah.
So I thought it's free streaming here on Tubi. I turned it on. And in the beginning, as you said, John Carradine is playing the author R. Chetwin Hayes, much older than Chetwin Hayes actually was at this time, I think, or he looks much, much older.
Yeah,
and he meets Vincent Price on the street and kind of just says to him, are you okay? Anything you need, I'll do for you. I'll do anything to make you feel better. And then Vincent Price is like, oh, I'm glad you said that. The fangs come out and then he bites his neck. It fades to black. And when it comes back up, nonchalantly, R. Chetwin Hayes is sort of patting his neck. And, you know, it's as if they just hooked up.
Yeah.
It has a very cruisy feel to it.
It sure does. Because he's kind of okay with it.
He just is okay with it. He's like, well, if that's what you needed, I gave you some. But he didn't kill him.
No.
Just helped a buddy out.
Yeah.
And then they go to this monster club. And the band in there is playing a song called Monsters Rule. And you would think I would love it, but it's just really bad. I was disappointed in that. But the monsters dancing around was pretty cool. We've talked enough about this movie.
Sure, sure, sure.
Let's conclude our bio of R. Chetwin Hayes.
In 1988, Chetwin Hayes won the Bram Stoker Award for Lifetime Achievement and the British Fantasy Society Special Award in 1989. He died in 2001 from pneumonia. Like you said, the story was published in 1975 in the Monster Club collection, which has the same wraparound as this movie, as we're talking about, except it's not Hayes. It's this character called Donald MacLeod.
If I could read this short excerpt from his bio in the Penguin Anthology, it says, the Monster Club, containing five stories, is generally considered his best work. While each story is excellent in itself, they are linked together by material that is as funny and clever as it is horrific. It is in this book that Chetwin Hayes set forth his monstrel table, a chart naming all the possible offspring of interbreeding among monsters. Speaking of non-Lovecraftian, you know.
Yeah, well, there you go, yeah.
He's like, I want all these monsters to hook up. I want to watch it. In the movie, actually, Vincent Price presents this whole table to the author.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It jumps in names where some things make sense. He's like, if a vampire and a werewolf have a baby, it's a werevamp. And if a werevamp and a werehuman have a baby, it's a shadmock. It's like, what? Where did that come from? Shadmock's whistle.
There's no name for it, so he's got to, you know, make it up.
Well, it's got these kind of fun rules. It's very goofy. I read the story when I was a teenager, and I was pretty solidly in the vampire and werewolf have a romance demographic.
Sure.
I don't know if I would have liked Twilight back then, but I definitely liked Anne Rice, and I was primed for something like that. The writing in here is brisk, it's sophisticated, it's witty, it's got all the gothic stuff, but it's also very funny. Mm-hmm. That opening that we heard, it sets up a pretty scary scene.
Yeah.
I think it works on that level as well. But I think the reason that the story actually stuck with me that I didn't remember was that under the surface, it's actually kind of a civil rights story.
Oh, yeah.
It's a cycle of violence story. It's a story about media representation of groups where there might be a little truth to something and it gets blown out of proportion and causes people to hate each other. So there's something that looks like it's going to be a cutesy crib of monster tropes like a Hotel Transylvania or something, but it actually turns out to be pretty sophisticated. And I think that that's what the story of the werewolf and the vampire is, surprisingly.
Yeah, let's get into it. It begins with a young, handsome English guy, George Hardcastle. He's out for a walk and hears a howl that sounds like an injured dog. Now, it's the middle of the day, so it's not creepy. He's actually worried about this poor dog, and he runs through the woods to try and find it.
Now, since the title is The Werewolf and the Vampire, I was pretty sure this wasn't an injured dog. Yeah. But it is cool that it's set in the middle of the day.
Yeah. Once he gets close to it, he hears a terrible growl. Pity fled like a leaf before raging wind, and stark terror fired his brain with blind, unreasoning panic. He ran, fell, got up and ran again, and from behind came the sound of a heavy body crashing through undergrowth, the rasp of labored breathing, the bestial growl of some enraged being. Reason had gone, coherent thought had been replaced by animal instinct for survival. He knew whatever ran behind him was closing the gap. George feels a sharp pain in his leg, and then he's out.
This chase through the woods went on for a good 15 minutes, it says. He was running this way and that. Mm-hmm. Not sure if this animal was menacing him or hurt or where it even was. Mm-hmm. The text was well-paced, and this is kind of a trope of an opening for a werewolf story. But, I mean, even the fact that it's daylight does remind me a little bit of The Howling, although this came out before that. Mm-hmm. But I was engaged. It was very hooky.
Now, when he wakes up, he finds a dead old guy.
A man in late middle life with gray, close-cropped hair, a long mustache and yellow teeth that were bared in a death grin. This purple face that he has suggests that he died of a heart attack, but I thought that was a bit of a stretch for a fellow of George's intellect to go, cause of death, heart attack. But George drags himself hurt through the woods to a main path and presumably passes out again. He's found the next morning by a team of Boy Scouts. And the police and a bunch of volunteers get together. They scour the woods for the ferocious wild beast that must have attacked him, but they don't find anything except for this dead man. An autopsy confirms the heart attack theory, and they think he had a heart attack when trying to help George, is what they assume.
Yes.
It says the entire episode assumed the proportions of a 9-day wonder and then was forgotten.
George's mother, Mrs. Hardcastle, takes care of her son, who's not feeling very well for a while, but he gets back up to snuff in about 3 weeks.
She doesn't want to pamper him, so she kind of just sends him out of the house to go walk.
On a cloudy, rainy day, he finds himself hanging out at Hampton Court Palace, and it's a touristy, castle-like locale west of London.
Have you been there?
I haven't been there, no, but I've seen it. If you saw pictures of it, you would know it. It's been in lots of movies and things. It's huge. It's a very ornate castle. I'm not sure if the royalty actually still use it anymore, if it's just like a museum or not.
But vampires probably do.
The vampires still use it for sure.
Yeah.
Now he's looking around in the audience chamber when he sees the goth girl of his dreams. A girl in a black dress. She was a beautiful study in black and white. Black hair, white face and hands, black dress. Not that there was anything sinister about her, for as she drew nearer, he could see the look of indescribable sadness in the large black eyes and the almost timid way she looked round each room. Her appearance was outstanding, so vivid, like a black and white photograph that had come to life.
Uh-oh. Revelations in black. When you go on vacation, you take a snack.
Dude, side note, I have been singing that nonstop. Revelations in black.
Let me tell you, 40 years they've been writing hits to Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
They're still just as good as they ever were.
Now this woman sees him checking him out, and she comes straight up to him, and she introduces herself. Her name is Carola.
In my head, I kept going Carola, and I was saying, why am I pronouncing it that way? And I guess it's because it's like Dracula.
All right, yeah.
So I think you can say it either way. But she gave him this look of something like recognition as she was bopping around this place. She walks up, like surprised that he's there, and then very confidently she approached him and introduced herself.
Yeah. Now, he's shocked that this girl would just come up and talk to him. And he's young and not very experienced with women, so he tries to play it cool, but he doesn't do well.
Obviously, this is probably another reason that the story clicked with me as a teenage boy. Because wouldn't it be great if I was just by myself brooding and a vampire girl just introduced herself to me aggressively?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Revelations in black.
Now, she also, like you said, acts like she knows him, but he thinks I never would have forgotten a girl like her. No way have I met her before. And she says they're in the same family, distantly related in an allegorical sense, which just confuses him. Mm. He tries to chat her up as best he can, and he says, isn't the weather awful? To which she is annoyed by. Mm-hmm. She says it's lovely weather with lots of beautiful clouds. He's confused by this again, and he says, well, hopefully the sun will be out soon, and this sets her off. Are you trying to frighten me? And he says, well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. And she goes, well, how would you like if I brought up silver bullets? That really stumps him. Obviously, we know what's going on because the story's called The Werewolf and the Vampire, so it all makes sense. But I love thinking about if this happened, this poor guy just trying to process all this stuff coming at him. And his response to that, he goes, well, I wouldn't know what you meant, but I wouldn't mind. And then she just runs off on a huff.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know what? That chick, she's off her rocker.
It's a light comic scene. She doesn't know that he doesn't know that he's a werewolf. And apparently vampires and werewolves just recognize each other because they're all a big monster family. So lots of mixed signals that will continue for the first part of this story. It's delightful. But it misleads you a bit because the story does eventually take a more serious turn. Although you could say that this type of comedy, you know, it's sort of a stand-in for things that do happen in the generational divides or urban-rural divides where there's misunderstandings. No, you can't say that. I'm trying real hard, but I don't know what the goalposts are.
Hey, have you ever had a good meet-cute?
I mean, I met my wife, Heather, on stage together doing comedy.
That's how you actually met her.
Yeah, I had seen her prior to that, but we actually spoke for the first time in a scene together. That was a good meet cute. I had one in college that I thought was so cool that I actually dramatized it in the film The Time Capsule. So
that
happened in front of a movie theater, and you could see it dramatized with Brianna Hildebrand playing the girl.
Oh, wow.
How about you?
The one that I always remember is the one that you actually literally set me up for, because I was trying to find a girlfriend in my early, early 20s, and you had written me a letter of recommendation that I would be a good boyfriend. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
It was a terribly written letter. Like, it was just really, it was misspelled, and it had all these, you know, it's like, Chris is a good friend, and he, you know, will hold my hand and go walking in the sunset with me and all this stuff. And then the end of it is signed Harrison Ford.
Right. I remember writing it in the music library at University of Illinois because there was a typewriter there. And I just wrote it as if it's just like a very simple-minded teenager or something wrote it. But it's celebrity Harrison Ford, essentially.
So I had this with me in my wallet. Being a bold, young 20-year-old guy, I would just go up and talk to a girl. There was this girl at a coffee house, and I was with my friends Heather and Elliot, and this girl was sitting by herself. And I go, wow, that girl's really cute. And they're like, you should go talk to her. And I'm like, I can't. And they go, what? Actually, I do have that letter of recommendation. And they're like, oh, you gotta do it. And I did. So I went up and I talked to her and I said, hey, how's it going? And she was looking at me a little suspiciously. And I go, okay, look, I know you don't know me, but I did bring a letter of recommendation. And I handed her the letter. And then she looked around like looking for the camera kind of thing. I mean, this is early 90s. So this is pre-internet shenanigans going on here.
Well, and everybody was hacking at that time.
Right, yeah. You know, she read the letter and she smiled and she's like, okay. And then we dated for like 3 months. So thank you for that one.
You're welcome. Well, let's thank you, Harrison Ford.
I got to thank Harrison Ford, yeah.
That's amazing, man. I forgot that actually worked out.
It worked. I only used it the one time because after I had broken up with that girl, I thought about using it again. But then if I met the girl of my dreams and she found out she was the second girl that got used on her, then it would be terrible. Man. So it got retired.
It would ruin Star Wars for her.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, back to the story. Later, he sees her and she approaches him again and she apologizes. And he apologizes too, and they're back to talking. She quickly says that he should meet her parents. And George is thinking, well, that's a bit fast. And she just laughs and says, you know, my parents are going to love having a guest that they don't have to pretend for.
Yeah, and he's not so dim that he doesn't see that there's lots of red flags here, but he really is smitten with her.
Yeah.
So he thinks, well, I guess it's just falling into place. He goes along with it.
The sun comes out from the clouds and Carola gets wigged out. But George comforts her and the sun goes back under cloud cover, and then she demands that he take her home. When he gets to their house, it has an iron gate, but it says it could be any house found in any London suburb. It's nothing special. It's not like a gothic, creepy, Addams Family-esque house. It's just a suburban house. A heavyset woman opens the door and welcomes her daughter in. She kisses her on the cheek, and she's excited to meet this boy. And she says, we thought you might have got caught in that sunstorm.
In Bizarro world, tires are square. This house is the first crack in that light comedy veneer, though.
Yeah.
As you say, you think it's going to be some Addams Family joint, and it gleamed with new paint and well-cleaned windows. So that's unexpected.
Now, she introduces George, realizing she didn't know his name yet. So she's, oh, this is, and he's like, George. Carola's mother is horrified, but then Carola whispers to her mother, and the horror turns to joy. Father will be pleased to have you around, not just two women in his ear all the time. She takes him to the parlor, which has nice furniture, a large television. Again, I keep forgetting that this is, you know, written in 1975, so people have TVs. There's a record player, and also some awful prints, which I thought was a nice detail.
And the macrame owl goes unmentioned, because you can't have, this is already the werewolf and the vampire. adding a haunted macrame owl would maybe be too much. But it's newly decorated for the 70s, so that means it does look like that. There's an artificial log electric fire. It gets mentioned more than once in the scene. That is the most normal non-Gothic thing I can think of.
Yeah.
You know, that is a conversation piece only for sort of bored human adults. Like, you got any heat out of that thing? How long you had that? Oh, yeah. I built a fire, but there's a lot to clean up, so I bet that's nice. I mean, this is not vampire material.
No. So the mother introduces George to the father, saying that he's all right, no need to worry. The dad is overjoyed to meet him, saying that it's about time his daughter settled down. And he says, I know you young doggies don't have to watch what you eat, but we could fry up some eggs. The wife never gets to cook. And again, that was another funny thing. Like, if you met somebody's parents, and the first thing they say is, hey, I'm going to cook you up some eggs.
Just excited.
I think that's rad. So I think the next time somebody comes over to my place, I'm going to go, hey, let me cook you up some eggs.
Yeah, don't offer him a drink either at all. Hey, you want some eggs? You want some fried eggs? Sit down. I'll fry you an egg. You don't have to fry your own egg here. This section of the story feels, as you're reading it, I was almost resisting it, like my eye-rolling teenager self was coming out, because it's like being with a bunch of people who are making corny jokes and you're resistant, but then you just have to go with it because they're committed to having fun.
Sure.
That's what the story's like at this point.
Yeah. And reluctantly, George agrees to eat, and the mother seems very happy about it.
Of course, I'm wondering why they have food in the kitchen at all.
Right.
Like, how often are they having humans over?
Right.
Are they murdering people in their home? Am I making that assumption about them? Shouldn't I get to know them first before I assume they murder people? I don't know.
Now, her father makes small talk about cloudy holidays, but then he asks George how often he changes. And George is confused by this question, and he says, every Friday, actually, after I've had a bath. And then I thought to myself, wait, he takes a bath once a week? He changes his clothes once a week? Who's this? Is that something English people did in the 70s? They would only bathe once a week?
You don't have to shower every day.
No, I don't shower. I shower every other day.
You know, talking about meet cutes, one time I was by myself at a bar doing some reading, and there was a blind date sitting right next to me. And it was not going well because they got on this topic. And this is a first date between the guy and the girl, and he's like, oh, I like to conserve water. That's what they were talking about. It was a little bit of ecology talk. And then he goes, I mean, for example, I probably only take a bath every third day. And there was this pause, and she goes, which day is it today? It was just like, I wanted to shake him. Man, this is not the thing you want to bring up on your date.
The father says, there's a goodish pong, but we have very keen noses.
What is a goodish pong? Meaning there's you smell bad?
Yeah, a strong smell.
Horrific circumstance. I know it's a misunderstanding, but can you imagine being told you smell bad?
Yes, of course.
In any circumstance. Oh, God.
Finally, the mother brings in some fried eggs and ham. She pours for them some red liquid into glasses, and the rest of them drink them through straws.
This is like an Aikman story, because you never find out what that red liquid is. It's the mystery that endures.
Sure does. Carola remarks that this is some good AB, but her mother says it's not as good as the real thing. George asks them why they're not eating, and they all look shocked. Carola admonishes him. The mother says that was rude. How would you like it if we talked about chewing on people on your moonlight strolls? And he goes, I don't chew anyone. Again, confused. The father says, there's some things we don't talk about around the ladies. With that, George is just fed up. He goes, look here, I'm fed up. If I mention the weather, I'm ticked off. If I ask why you never eat, I'm in trouble. I've been asked when I change, told that I stink. Now, after being accused of chewing people, I'm told I mustn't mention it. Now I'll tell you something. I think you're all round the bend.
Oh, my.
And it kicks off. Father swears. The mother looks concerned, but she is starting to figure things out. She goes, are you trying to tell us you don't know the score? And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. And she says, he's a just bitten her.
Mercifully, the farce comes to an end. They realize he doesn't know he's a werewolf yet.
Yes. Father says, hell's bells, my dad didn't have to tell me I was a vampire.
So vampires in this situation are born.
I guess so. Mother asks George if he was attacked recently, and he nods, and he looks at the door, ready to run. She mentions that there's due to be a full moon that Friday, and she warns him that he needs to find an open place to run. And he says, well, I live by Clapham Common. And she says, well, that's good, but make sure you cover your face. Normal people get pretty wigged out about the change.
George was on his feet and edging his way towards the door. He was praying for the priceless gift of disbelief, Mummy was again displaying signs of annoyance. "Now there's no need to carry on like that. You must have known we were all vampires. What did you think we were drinking? Raspberry juice? And let me tell you this, we're the best friends you've got. No one else will want to know you once full moon is peeping over the barn door, so don't get all lawn tennis with us." But George was gone, running across the hall and out the front door, down the crazy paving path and finally along the pavement. People turned their heads as he shouted, "They're mad, mad, mad!"
Don't get all lawn tennis with us.
What does that mean?
I've never heard that before. That's great.
Yeah.
But I think that's actually a good place to stop.
Yeah, that's a good break. The tone changes a little bit in the second half, and that'll be good meat for another episode. Mm-hmm. They straight up worship Satan, by the way. You know, I was like, this would be a good story for middle school or something like that. But here and there, they're like, "Hail Satan." There's the part the band says to him, "Hey, look, what you do when you change, that's between you and Black Man," meaning like Black Philip in the woods, witchcraft stuff.
Right, right, right.
Given that, are they bad monsters?
As in, are they evil? Do they wish harm upon people? It doesn't seem to be the case. They talk about they miss drinking real blood, and it looks like they're getting their blood from like a hospital or something.
Yeah.
So they're not killing people.
There's something that the mother says along the lines of, you know, "We're monsters, but we're harder on ourselves than we really are bad." Something along those lines, that she doesn't think that they're all that bad. I think that's important for the next episode. You know, I think that they are monsters, but they're trying to be different. I don't know. It seems they've changed. And also that there are a lot of things that we think we know about them that we don't really know. Like, are these vampires growing older?
We don't know. I mean, they're having children, and the children are growing up and getting married. So I guess they are different than what we think of as your typical vampires. But we'll talk about it more next week. I want to thank Mike Mason. He does great work. I worked with him on our book, Cult of Cthulhu. He's a really talented guy. And of course, if you get the chance, ask him about thimbles.
I want to thank some patrons as well. And I'm going to start by saying thank you, Jonathan Hagland.
Eric Cook, thank you.
Liam Page, thank you.
I'd like to thank Helen Krumpholt.
Ellie J, thanks.
Hey, Dale Wilson, thank you.
Aw, what's up, Dale? I was supposed to play, I couldn't because I was out of town. I was supposed to play Dungeons and Dragons with him just the other night.
He's a treasure.
He's the best. I'd like to thank Blake Presythe.
Ian Gallagher, thank you.
Taylor, thank you.
Zachariah Inks, thank you.
Thank you, Kaz.
Sam Brendan Rode, thank you.
Kent Damgard, thank you.
Benjamin Arendt, thank you.
And finally, Michael Hanready, thank you so much. You guys are the best. Really appreciate your support. I hope you'll hang in with us as we get into the next part of The Werewolf and the Vampire by R. Chetwynd Hayes next week. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.